Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Wall Street Journal Business News for Wednesday, December 17th, 2025. And here are today's business headlines. Warner rejects Paramount's hostile bid, saying Netflix deal still superior. Podcasters love YouTube. That's making podcast advertising less predictable. The Squishy Number Behind the Rise and Fall of Oracle Stock by Jonathan Wheel. Diageo to sell Kenyan Drinks stakes to Japan Asahi for $2.3 billion by Joshua Kirby. EW Scripps rejects Sinclair's acquisition offer by Catherine Hamilton. Warner preparing to tell shareholders to reject Paramount offer by Lauren Thomas and Joe Flint. DAZN in advanced talks for stake in broadcaster Main Street Sports by Lauren Thomas. Our first article today is Warner rejects Paramount's hostile bid, saying Netflix deal still superior by Lauren Thomas and Joe Flint. Warner Brothers Discovery recommended shareholders reject Paramount's unsolicited all-cash bid for the company Wednesday, saying it believes Netflix's proposal for its studios and HBO Max streaming service is still superior. Calling the Paramount offer illusory in a letter to shareholders, Warner again raised concerns about the credibility of the equity being offered by Paramount and questions the structure of the Ellison family's commitment to funding the deal. It added that Paramount has consistently misled Warner shareholders. Paramount Chief Executive David Ellison and his father Larry, the billionaire co-founder of Oracle, are majority shareholders in Paramount, along with Redbird Capital. Netflix earlier this month agreed to pay $72 billion, or $27.75 a share, in cash and stock for Warner's studio and HBO Max streaming business, after the entertainment company splits itself in two. Paramount then went hostile to acquire all of Warner. Paramount has been arguing that its offer is a better deal for shareholders and more likely to pass regulatory muster. The Wall Street Journal reported Tuesday that a rejection from Warner was imminent. Warner said that the Ellison family is using a revocable trust to fund the deal, and that documents provided by Paramount about the commitment contain gaps, loopholes, and limitations that put you, our shareholders, and our company at risk. The Netflix merger, on the other hand, is fully backed by a public company with a market cap of more than $400 billion and with an investment-grade balance sheet, Warner said. The terms of the Netflix merger are superior, Warner said in its letter. The Paramount offer provides inadequate value and imposes numerous significant risks and costs on Warner. Paramount didn't immediately comment Wednesday morning. Paramount's hostile bid is at $30 a share, though the company has also told Warner that this offer isn't its best and final proposal, a signal it could increase the bid. Its tender offer is set to expire on January 8th, but can be extended. The company will now have to decide whether it will submit a sweetened offer. Warner shares closed Tuesday at $28.90, falling after the Journal reported on the coming rejection and shares were slipping further pre-market. Paramount's bid initially included capital from three Gulf sovereign wealth funds, as well as Jared Kushner's Affinity Partners. As of Tuesday, Affinity was no longer involved in the deal. The dynamics of the investment have changed significantly since we initially became involved in October, an Affinity spokesman said, adding the firm continues to see strong strategic rationale for Paramount's offer. Kushner wasn't the linchpin for the Middle East funds involved in the deal, so his exit isn't expected to upset the wider group, people familiar with the matter said. Paramount has said repeatedly that it didn't hear back from Warner so that it could improve its offer. Warner countered this, saying that its board repeatedly engaged with all parties, holding dozens of calls and meetings with the principals and the Ellisons. The company said it raised the concerns about the funding to Paramount and the Ellisons and gave them several opportunities to change the offer. Warner also said Wednesday that its board didn't believe there was a material difference in regulatory risk between Paramount offer and the Netflix deal. Both bids have ignited concerns in Hollywood about job cuts and other consequences from further industry consolidation. Warner said the Paramount deal would make Hollywood weaker, not strong. Netflix co-CEO Ted Sarandos said, following Warner's decision, that Netflix and Warner complement each other. A shareholder vote on the deal isn't expected to happen until spring or even summer. Write to Lauren Thomas at lauren.thomas@wsj.com and Joe Flint at joe.flint@wsj.com. Our next article is Warner rejected Paramount's tender offer, What to Know. The entertainment company's share price suggests shareholders expect a sweetened bid, by Lauren Thomas and Ben Glickman. Warner Brothers Discovery on Wednesday recommended shareholders reject Paramount's unsolicited bid for the company, questioning the funding structure for the deal. Here's what to know about the drama that could play out. A tender offer makes a direct appeal to shareholders to sell or tender their shares at a set price. They're often employed when the target company's board won't engage. Paramount had accused Warner of not meaningfully engaging with any of its 6 takeover offers. Tender offers gave shareholders a deadline for participating that can often be extended. Warner's shareholders have until January 8th to decide whether to accept Paramount's $30 per share all-cash bid unless the deadline is extended. If a tender offer looks like it has widespread support, boards of the company being sold tend to capitulate and negotiate a deal before the deadline. Even without the endorsement of Warner's board, Paramount can still take its appeal directly to Warner shareholders. That can come in the form of mailed materials to stockholders or websites, advertisements, and media appearances. Paramount, at any point, could also decide to up its offers to shareholders, which would prompt Warner's board to reevaluate the new deal terms. If Paramount persuades a majority of holders to tender their shares, it would gain control of the company with or without a board recommendation. The Warner board's announcement means that the agreement with Netflix still stands and Netflix doesn't have to make any changes to its offer. If at any point in the future a Paramount offer is deemed superior to Netflix, Netflix would have 4 business days to match or top it per the merger agreement. If Warner were to walk away from its deal with Netflix, it would owe the streaming company a $2.8 billion breakup fee. Netflix, on the other hand, would owe Warner a whopping $5.8 billion if for some reason its deal didn't go through because of regulatory or other issues. That is one of the biggest breakup fees of all time. Netflix has lost around $100 billion in market value since mid-September, when speculation started to swirl that it would be making some sort of play for Warner's assets. And after the Wall Street Journal reported that Paramount was preparing a bid of its own, and that could suggest its shareholders might not have a big appetite for a sweetened bid. Of all hostile tender offers involving multiple bidders since 2000, about 29% have resulted in completed deals, according to an analysis of LSEG data by the Wall Street Journal. The portion is slightly lower for deals valued at $10 billion or more. Paramount's bid for Warner, if completed, would be the biggest hostile and competitive tender offer to succeed. The current largest is Royal Bank of Scotland's deal for National Westminster Bank, completed in 2000 and valued at over $36 billion, according to LSEG data. Other memorable hostile bids include the attempted buyout of Botox maker Allergan by Valeant Pharmaceuticals and Pershing Square Capital Management in 2015. The offer was dropped after Allergan accepted a higher-valued friendly deal. Paramount has been arguing that its deal is more likely to pass regulatory muster than Netflix, given that Netflix is already a major player in the streaming industry. While Netflix deal is expected to be investigated by the Justice Department, more so than in previous administrations, the White House is likely to influence where regulators land on any deal. Paramount's bid is backed by the Ellison family, Trump allies, and its equity backers include three Gulf sovereign wealth funds, Affinity Partners, the private equity firm of President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, had been involved in the deal but later backed out. Asked about the competing proposals this week, Trump said he wasn't close to either company. I have to see what percentage of market they have. None of them are particularly great friends of mine, Trump said at a White House roundtable. Trump had suggested previously that Netflix deal could be a problem and said he'd be involved in deciding whether to bless it. He has also separately criticized Paramount for having Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican critic of his, on CBS's 60 Minutes recently. This explanatory article may be periodically updated. Write to Lauren Thomas at lauren.thomas@wsj.com and Ben Glickman at ben.glickman@wsj.com. Podcasters love YouTube. That's making podcast advertising less predictable. Ads that appear in video podcasts are alluring for visually minded marketers, but may perform worse on the whole than audio only, according to a new study by Katie Dayton. Podcast ads may be better heard than seen, a new study suggests, even as the popularity of video podcasting skyrockets. Host-read podcast ads on YouTube are up to 25% less effective at driving purchases than in audio-only advertisements. According to research on more than 1,000 campaigns that was conducted by the marketing agency Oxford Road and the audio measurement firm Podscribe. That could partly reflect consumers' differing mindsets with each format, said Giles Martin, Executive Vice President of Strategy at Oxford Road. Listeners on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify tend to deliberately select shows, whereas YouTube audiences sometimes arrive via algorithmic suggestions, Martin said. The listening experience can also be more intimate and immersive than the bustling, brightly lit environment of YouTube. With YouTube, a medium with a screen, you have thumbnails, other options competing for your attention and encouraging you to click away, Martin said. So if your attention isn't immediately grabbed within the first 30 seconds or the first 2 minutes, it's very, very easy to lose viewers. Google said in response that advertisers on YouTube already recognize the differences between audio-only services and its video ad offerings. But the ad spots on video and audio-only podcasts are often sold the same way, through the same channels and at the same price, Martin said, and Google's longtime walled garden approach to measurement makes it difficult for advertisers to track campaigns consistently across video and audio-only channels, he added. For the best part of two decades, people consumed podcasts just by listening, and podcasters produced shows without a camera in sight. But shows looking to expand their audiences gradually began uploading episodes on YouTube, drawn by its huge consumer reach and tools for creators to make money. YouTube, by 2024, had surpassed Spotify to become the most popular podcast platform in the U.S., according to research firm Edison Research Podcast Measurement Business. The company, part of Google, in February said that there are more than a billion monthly active viewers of podcast content on the platform, and some 71% of U.S. podcast creators now produce video versions of their shows alongside audio, with just under half of those podcasting in a video-only format, according to Podcast Trade Association Sounds Profitable. Creating visually compelling ads, especially ones that still make sense for consumers who are listening but not watching, isn't easy. While many podcasters are happy to take the lead on producing high-quality, TV-like spots to keep viewers engaged, advertisers say others simply read to the camera without adding any visuals more intriguing than a discount code. But some podcast advertisers say the effort is worth it. The visual storytelling that makes all of the difference for us, because it allows consumers to quickly see how the product works, said Melton Littlepage, the chief marketing officer of identity security company iPassword. Its results from podcast advertising increased when it began appearing on video podcasts last year, according to Littlepage. The company sends video podcasters marketing footage, brand assets, and talking points, but usually lets the show producers develop the final ad. It does take a moment of time to forge that personal relationship with the host, Littlepage said, but when they deliver a message about a sponsored product authentically in the tone and style of the podcast, audiences don't click off. Other brands are preparing to follow the consumer shift. Video podcasting is increasingly becoming the norm, and our approach reflects that, said Sarah Brooks, chief growth officer at online therapy company BetterHelp, describing podcasts as the cornerstone of the brand's marketing mix. Its experience of video podcast ads so far has been a grab bag of host reads on to camera, recording combined with static images and some fully produced segments, she said. Looking ahead to 2026 and beyond, we're doubling down on visual opportunities, Brooks said. YouTube hopes to keep video podcasting growing. Next year, it plans to test a tool designed to turn audio podcasts into video, even without cameras in the studio. Another tool will let podcasters swap out sponsored segments in their videos, which as of now are often hard-coded into the video file and still remain online even after a sponsorship ends. Katie Dayton writes for WSJ Leadership Institute's CMO Today. Reach her at katie.deighton@wsj.com. The holidays came early this year, at least for advertisers. Brands are chasing inflation-weary shoppers with plentiful TV spots that launched long before Halloween, by Suzanne Vranica. Tired of Santas and relentlessly cheerful snowmen filling every screen? Blame the advertisers. Advertisers kicked off the holiday season even earlier this year, and they are inundating TVs with commercials. The activity comes despite continuing efforts by many businesses to rein in costs to contend with tariffs. Holiday TV ads started in earnest in early October, and companies have spent a combined $1.47 billion over the past 9 weeks, a 13% jump compared with the year-ago period, according to estimates from ad tracker iSpot. That figure doesn't include the massive investments in digital promotions flooding social media, email inboxes, and text messages. Retailers spent $5.8 billion on digital ads in the U.S. from November 1st to December 7th, a 4% increase from the same period a year ago, according to research firm Sensor Tower. The holiday shopping season remains a critical moment for retailers, and with inflation still weighing on household budgets, brands aren't taking any chances at losing out on the action. The National Retail Federation is projecting that holiday sales will surpass $1 trillion for the first time this year. A handful of retailers are proving particularly busy on the TV ad front so far this holiday season. Walmart's ads feature a Dr. Seuss-inspired world, starring Walton Goggins as the Grinch. Target, meanwhile, brings back Chris Kay, a jolly bearded Christmas enthusiast introduced in a 2024 campaign. In Target's spot, a woman with whom he is on a coffee date gets a peek at his gift list and leaves him confused by referencing his naughty list. Amazon.com has almost doubled the number of holiday ad minutes it has aired on TV during the past 9 weeks, iSpot estimates. The earlier commencement of the holiday retail season, commonly referred to as Christmas creep, has long influenced Madison Avenue's holiday ad strategies. However, this year, many brands accelerated their TV ad campaigns even further, ad buyers and consultants said. Some companies began holiday ads in early August. They got a jump on the season in part because they saw signs that consumers were worried about inflation and potential tariff-driven price increases, and therefore wanted to spread out their holiday budgets across a longer period of time, said Suzanne Irving, president of Integrated Investment at ad buying firm OMD. Amazon, one of the largest advertisers in the country, aired its first holiday TV ad on October 13th, a far cry from last year when it ran its first holiday commercial on November 1st, according to iSpot. The ad shows a college student arriving home to see that her childhood bedroom now contains a treadmill, with her father running on it awkwardly, wearing short shorts. The young woman checks the Amazon app for more appropriate workout gear. Despite the deluge, Americans generally like holiday ads, according to an online poll conducted this month by Morning Consult for the Wall Street Journal. This stands in contrast to the often criticized ad blitzes associated with political election cycles. 2/3 of respondents said they enjoy seeing holiday-themed ads, either a lot or somewhat. Just 9% expressed dislike. But many, including 70% of baby boomers, felt the spots started too early. Write to Suzanne Vranica at suzanne@wsj.com. Retail sales stalled in October. Some sales came in flat with September, while economists polled by the Wall Street Journal were expecting growth of 0.1%, by Matt Grossman. U.S. retail sales decelerated this fall, the Census Bureau said Tuesday, adding to evidence that the economy has cooled in recent months. The report, delayed by the recent government shutdown, showed that sales in retail stores were flat in October, after growing by 1% in September. Economists polled by the Wall Street Journal were expecting a growth of 0.1%. Momentum for retailers has moderated in recent months, suggesting a downshift in consumer spending. During 2024, retail sales growth averaged closer to 0.5% a month. Analysts are poring over a flood of catch-up economic data as the U.S. statistics system gets back on its feet after the recent government shutdown. Also on Tuesday morning, new data from the Labor Department showed that hiring seesawed in the October and November, with unemployment ticking up 4.6%. As the delayed stats filter in, most indications confirm the economy has avoided an abrupt downturn. The jobless rate has climbed only gradually. It remains modest by historical standards. Corporate earnings grew at a solid pace in the 3 months during through September. Many economists expect stronger economic growth next year, especially if anxiety about fast-changing tariffs abates. Yet, households are facing challenges on multiple fronts, a pressure point for the broader economy, given the outsized role of consumer spending. Sluggish hiring has meant extended searches for people out of work, and there are far fewer job openings per job seeker than earlier in the decade. Wage growth has decayed, and persistently elevated inflation is straining personal budgets. Some consumer surveys measure the economic mood near all-time lows. Indications from major retailers have been mixed. Walmart and clothing chains such as Gap and TJ Maxx have posted buoyant results that pointed ahead to a strong holiday shopping season. Others, including Home Depot and Target, have recently delivered downbeat figures and projections that suggest shoppers have turned more cautious. There are also signs inflation-weary consumers are pushing back on retailers' attempts to increase prices. Grocery executives report shoppers are choosing smaller package sizes or shifting to more affordable stores. Costco and other wholesale clubs have increasingly drawn on their private label brands to offer shoppers better deals. Write to Matt Grossman at Matt, that's M-A-T-T, dot Grossman, G-R-O-S-S-M-A-N, at WSJ.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. The squishy number behind the rise and fall of Oracle stock. AI investors are scrutinizing a once obscure metric related to future sales. By Jonathan Wheel. Signing a 12-figure contract with a customer is one thing. Collecting is a whole other matter. A once obscure footnote disclosure called Remaining Performance Obligations, or RPOs, has become one of the most closely watched numbers for investors in AI-themed stocks, especially Oracle. It's also a lot squishier than investors may realize, helping to explain the recent sharp fall in Oracle stock. RPOs, which have a standard definition across companies, represent contracted sales that have yet to be recognized as revenue. In other words, management believes the sales are probable, not definite. Because of that, RPOs aren't on the face of a company's financial statement. Analysts use the number to help shape their future estimates of the company's business. If they start to doubt the future sales are indeed probable, they're likely to take a dimmer view of a company's outlook. Oracle stock soared in early September, at one point jumping 36%. In a single day, after a bombshell earnings report in which it said its RPOs had more than tripled since the previous quarter to $455 billion. Since then, Oracle's RPOs have jumped to $523 billion as of November 30th, or about 9 times Oracle's revenue for the past 4 quarters. Yet the stock has cratered, down 43% from its all-time high on September 10th. Investors have grown uneasy about the circular nature of many of the AI sector's dealings and are looking askance at huge gains in RPOs. They are particularly wary about OpenAI's ability to meet gargantuan future commitments. It's widely known that about $300 billion of the increase in RPOs at Oracle was due to a 5-year contract with OpenAI to supply computing capacity, although Oracle hasn't expressly disclosed this. To meet the demand, Oracle is building new colossal data center complexes across the country. The $300 billion portion from the OpenAI has drawn skepticism from investors and even some Wall Street analysts. J.P. Morgan credit analyst Erica Speer titled her December 15th note on Oracle, "If you build it, will they pay?" D.A. Davidson analyst Gil Luria, in a December 12th note, said, "Since OpenAI is unlikely to deliver on its $300 billion commitment, we believe the best course of action for Oracle would be to restructure that contract proactively in order to deploy capital more responsibly instead of pretending it has $523 billion of RPO. OpenAI is closely held and doesn't disclose its financial reports. It has about $1.4 trillion of commitments over the next 8 years, according to a December 5th report by Moody's. But it has comparatively little revenue, and it's still in the fundraising stage. OpenAI has said it's on pace to top $20 billion of annualized revenue by the end of the year. Equity investors include SoftBank, which has agreed to invest $30 billion. Uncertainty about NVIDIA's plans with OpenAI and the possible impact on Oracle exemplifies the circularity that characterizes much of the AI sector. Oracle is a major customer of NVIDIA, which someday might be investing in OpenAI, which recently signed a big contract with Oracle. The pact between OpenAI and NVIDIA has taken longer than initially expected. The companies on September 22nd announced a letter of intent for a deal in which NVIDIA would invest as much as $100 billion in OpenAI over many years, and OpenAI would buy millions of NVIDIA's specialized chips for its AI infrastructure. At the time, NVIDIA and OpenAI said they expected to finalize the deals in the coming weeks, but that was almost 3 months ago. In its latest quarterly report, NVIDIA said, there's no assurance that any investment will be completed on expected terms, if at all. If NVIDIA backs away from OpenAI, maybe another investor would step up to fill the gap, but maybe not. Or if it turns out OpenAI can't pay Oracle the full $300 billion, maybe Oracle could land another gigantic customer to fill its place. Suffice it to say, if NVIDIA's investment in OpenAI fell through, it likely would be bad news for Oracle's stock. It might be far from certain that OpenAI will be able to pay Oracle the $300 billion. But the relevant question is how far. That's the difference between recognizing the contracted amounts as RPOs or not. Whether companies are allowed to record RPOs comes down, in part, to a simple question that might not have an easy answer. Is collectability probable under the accounting rules? It's possible different people looking at the same facts could reasonably reach different conclusions. It's also possible for management's conclusions to change as facts change. What looks probable today might not look that way a year from now. The accounting rules don't define probable in percentage terms, but it is a higher bar than more likely than not. In practice, some accountants peg the threshold as 70% or higher. The numbers behind the artificial intelligence boom are mind-bogglingly large. Whether they are all real is a judgment call. Write to Jonathan Wheel at jonathan.wheel@wsj.com. The eerie parallels between AI mania and the dot-com bubble. Bulls deny that there is a 1990s-style bubble in AI. There are a few striking similarities and some notable differences. By James McIntosh. Is it karma? Coincidence? Either way, the ghost of the dot-com bubble is back 25 years later. Shares in Cisco Systems, the dot-com era champion that became the world's most valuable company at its peak in March 2000, this week reached that level again for the first time. It's a cautionary tale of how far stock prices can depart from reality. Bulls spend a lot of time denying that there's a 1990-style bubble inflating again in artificial intelligence. But it's worth going through a few of the striking similarities and some notable differences. Valuation. There are lots of ways of valuing stocks, and pretty much all of them make U.S. shares look the most expensive since the dot-com bubble. The forward price-to-earnings ratio, price-to-cash flow, and the Fed model calculation of the extra reward offered by stocks compared with bonds and the cyclicity adjusted P.E. ratio all scream that stocks are expensive. The reason is common to them all. Investors are, just as in the 1999-2000 betting, on a new technology to deliver much faster than usual profit growth. If it happens, it justifies higher valuations. Uncertainty. Just as the dot-coms were priced based on hope that the internet would deliver a new era of profits from business models that were yet to be proven, so with AI. Generative AI has delivered chatbots and image generation that seem to be not far from magic, but is for now priced well below what it costs to produce, leading to big losses at AI businesses. One difference, many of the pure-play dot-coms didn't have that revenue, while the AI companies are at least making some sales. Investment. The internet was built on a global network of fiber optic cables laid by telecom companies, leading to heavy corporate spending financed by debt. The large language models behind advanced AI are built on giant data centers, leading to heavy corporate investment increasingly financed by debt, as well as by big tech's cash from its legacy businesses. The numbers in 2000 were immense, with well over $100 billion being sunk into new telecom networks in the late 1990s. There was so much fiber that much of it ended up mothballed for a decade before internet traffic expanded enough to justify using it. The race to build data centers is even more extreme, with investment figures in the trillions thrown around by leading AI developers. Spending is so large that economists say it's making up a significant share of gross domestic product growth. Companies that sell the equivalent of picks and shovels to the gold rush have done extremely well. In 2000, it was Cisco, maker of the routers needed to connect up the internet, and the telecoms companies where the sector boosted earnings by a quarter in the final year of the bubble. Today, it's NVIDIA and other chip makers supplying the processing power to the data centers and raking in profits. NVIDIA's growth is better than Cisco was, but both are extraordinary. In the 1999, Cisco's revenue expanded more than 40%, and in 2000, more than 50%. NVIDIA, in the past 12 months, managed first more than 150%, and then, in the 12 months to October, 60%. This growth naturally excites investors. Single-minded market. In 1999, more stocks in the S&P 500 fell than rose. So far this year, 183, or 37% of them, are down. Anything AI-related, chip makers, power generators, producers of equipment used to build data centers, is up, and much of the rest of the market is down. In 1999, if you were an internet stock, you boomed, and if you weren't, no one was interested. Much the same applies today to AI. Retail trading. Individuals are dominating stock trading, again betting big on tiny, loss-making companies. In both the 2000 bubble and the 2021 bubble, in SPACs, clean tech, crypto, and cannabis, loss-making small stocks far and away beat profitable small stocks, which are much less exciting. This shows up in the Russell 2000 index of smaller companies beating the S&P 600, which requires companies to show profits before being included, by 10 percentage points in the 12 months to mid-October before the pattern reversed. The Russell smaller gauge has beaten the S&P 600 by as much only three times before, 1999 to 2000, 2020 to 21, and the rebound from post-dot-com low in 2002. The Russell Microcap Index has been even more extreme, beating the S&P 600 by 25 percentage points over a year before falling back. This trading boom has powered Robinhood markets up 220% this year, just as the dot-com trading boom powered E-Trade Financial, now part of Morgan Stanley, up 261% in 1999. Some say if everyone is talking about a bubble, it's a sign there isn't one. Yet bubble arguments raged in 1999, even as it continued to inflate. The same is happening now. Exponential growth. One big difference between now and 1999 to 2000 is the scale of price gains. Sure, NVIDIA's up a lot, really a lot, but gains in the company's shares of 54% this year to an October peak and 30%, including the drop since then, pale in comparison to the leaps in 1999. Cisco more than doubled in 4 months from mid-October 1999, while Apple was up 150% that year, and Intel gained 75% in just under 3 months early in 2000. Even the best big stocks this year, names such as Western Digital, Seagate, and Micron Technology, only tripled or quadrupled to their peaks this week, before falling hard on Friday. In 1999, Qualcomm soared 2,620%. It took until 2020 before it recovered from the subsequent bust. Ultimately, whether this is a bubble depends on whether it pops. If it turns out AI can't deliver both the promised productivity gains and fat profits for its creators, the parallel will be the painful dot-com aftermath, not the boom. Write to James McIntosh at james.mcintosh@wsj.com. Corrections and amplifications. Cisco shares doubled in 4 months from mid-October 1999. An earlier version of this article incorrectly said they doubled in a month, corrected on December 15th. CEOs are learning to live with Trump's turn to state capitalism. Some businesses have figured out how to take advantage of an expanded government presence in their boardrooms. By Greg Ipp. Last week, NVIDIA finally got permission to sell one of its most advanced semiconductor chips to China. The catch? The federal government will take 25% of the revenue from those sales. The NVIDIA deal says something important about the relationship between business and government under President Trump. His regular intrusions into the boardroom, taking equity stakes, revenue slices, or a golden share, prodding companies to lower prices or sell drugs through a federal website, are a sort of state capitalism, in which the state doesn't necessarily own companies, but issues its substantial leverage to steer their behavior. State capitalism is a two-way street. Many businesses, by aligning themselves with Trump's agenda, elicit better treatment. In their ability to sell to China, the tariffs they pay, how they are regulated, and what mergers are allowed. In other words, state capitalism doesn't just serve the interests of the state, but of favored capitalists. NVIDIA is in effect paying for a license that used to be free, but it hasn't objected. After all, it's getting access to a lucrative market that would otherwise be off limits. In August, shortly after Trump first proposed a 15% cut, Chief Executive Jensen Huang told an interviewer, "Whatever it takes to get it approved for us is to be able to sell in China is fine with us." Whether this cozy relationship between the state and selected capitalists is good for the country is another question. State capitalism is neither a socialism, in which the government owns the means of production, or laissez-faire capitalism. It's more of a hybrid, variants of which have been long and commonplace outside the U.S. Once popular in Japan and Western Europe, it remains prominent in China, Russia, and other countries to varying degrees. In the U.S., taking stakes in companies or commandeering their production was once limited to wars or emergencies such as a financial crisis and COVID. Trump has made it standard practice. "I think we should take stakes in companies," Trump told the Wall Street Journal last week. "Now, some people would say that doesn't sound very American. Actually, I think it's very American." Privately, many business leaders recoil from Trump's intrusions, just as they deplore his attacks on the Federal Reserve and on law firms and media companies that cross him. Publicly, they're mostly silent or even supportive. The reasons are complex. Fear is one reason. Solidarity with the president's broader agenda is another. After former President Joe Biden's regulatory and enforcement onslaught, many are thrilled with Trump's business-friendly appointments. He's rolling back business regulations and oversight, waving through more mergers, and signing business tax cuts into law. Most would prefer a government that is both light touch and arm's length. With Trump, that's not really an option, so many seek to work with him and his inner circle closely on their most important goals. Pfizer, for example, agreed to lower prices on some drugs for U.S. buyers, sell some through a federal portal dubbed TrumpRx, and invest in U.S. manufacturing. In return for relief from tariffs, at a White House event, Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla thanked Trump and promised the historic agreement would meet the demands Trump had set out to lower drug cost. Staying on Trump's good side also didn't hurt when Pfizer found itself in a bidding war for Metsera, an anti-obesity drug startup, against Denmark's Novo Nordisk. Mike Davis, a Republican legal activist with close connections to Trump's inner circle, demanded an op-ed that Trump and the Federal Trade Commission not stand by while a foreign company, Novo, attempts to circumvent our government's necessary antitrust oversight. The FTC then raised concerns about how it structured its bid, promoting Metsera to sell itself to Pfizer. The FTC did what they thought was the right thing to do, and has nothing to do with my relations with the Trump administration, Bourla said on CNBC. The alignment between state and capitalists has been most evident in the pursuit of artificial intelligence. Silicon Valley and Trump are united in their conviction that the AI race is crucial to sustaining U.S. economic growth and strategic leadership over China. From the get-go, Silicon Valley threw its support behind Trump. Top executives attended his inauguration. At the White House the next day, the president announced a $500 billion AI infrastructure project dubbed Stargate, led by OpenAI, Oracle, and SoftBank. Trump has, meanwhile, strongly backed the industry's priorities. He repealed Biden's AI guidance on national security and public health, and has pushed for more energy to meet AI's ravenous electricity needs. Last week, Trump signed an executive order to punish states that regulate AI. Key tech imports, including NVIDIA's chips and Apple's iPhones, have so far been largely spared tariffs. Beyond simply boosting the industry, the Trump administration is participating alongside it. Shortly after Trump demanded and got a 10% equity stake in Intel, NVIDIA also invested in the company, a supplier and potential competitor. That was just one of the many circular deals that have blurred the lines between competitors, customers, and in some cases, the federal government itself. NVIDIA has also invested in OpenAI, Anthropic, and xAI, all of which use NVIDIA chips. Microsoft, which provides computing power to OpenAI and Anthropic, has invested in both. SoftBank has invested in OpenAI, and OpenAI has a warrant for shares of AMD, a competitor to NVIDIA. It bears a passing resemblance to the interlocking ownership that once characterized the Japanese economy. On the one hand, cooperation among key AI players could turbocharge investment and keep the U.S. ahead of China. On the other, it could raise barriers to outsiders to the detriment of competition and innovation. AI's circular deals are not straight acquisitions. They're more like partnerships and co-investments, said Doha Mekki, who served in the Justice Department's antitrust division in the first Trump and Biden administrations. But if you diagram them out, they start to look trust-like in their combinations, a reference to the corporate entities targeted by the first antitrust laws. The antitrust agencies should be asking questions about the relationships. So far, competition in AI looks pretty healthy, and the Justice Department says it's on the lookout for anti-competitive behavior. In the grander scheme, though, the administration cares more about building national champions than it can compete abroad than preserving competition at home. It allowed Hewlett-Packard Enterprise to acquire rival Juniper Networks over the objections of Justice Department antitrust staffers. The apparent rationale: the combined company would be a stronger competitor to China's Huawei. Google parent Alphabet's $32 billion acquisition of cybersecurity startup Wiz, which what Biden appointees would likely have opposed, appears headed for approval. If AI is, as widely feared, a bubble, its bursting would jeopardize the capital that finances data centers and U.S. economic growth. Cognizant of these risks, some in Silicon Valley think Washington should stand behind the industry, as it once stood behind the banks. OpenAI has called for federal grants, cost-sharing agreements, loans, or loan guarantees to expand industrial-based capacity and resilience. No company fits the national champion profile better than NVIDIA, which has a commanding market share in the graphical processing units used in AI model training and inference. Both the Biden and at first Trump administration blocked NVIDIA from selling many of its most advanced chips to China. With AI prowess seen as critical to economic and military dominance, the restrictions were intended to slow the advance of top Chinese AI modelers such as DeepSeek. Huang met repeatedly with Trump and other officials and went to Capitol Hill. He argued that allowing sales would secure U.S. leadership by keeping Chinese developers dependent on an American tech stack. Without U.S. chips, he said earlier this month at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, they're going to go build their own complete stack. Once they've built that entire complete stack, they'll export it as quickly as you could imagine. Inside the White House, tech advisor David Sachs made the same argument, drawing parallels to how Huawei leapfrogged Western companies to take the lead in 5G telecommunications. He wrote on X, "China is exporting Huawei chips, DeepSeek models, to the global south. If we don't make it just as easy to export the American AI stack, we will forfeit this technology race in large parts of the world." Before Trump, Biden had already embraced industrial policy government support for favored sectors. He signed the Bipartisan CHIPS Act, which funneled billions of dollars in grants to Intel and others to build facilities that could fabricate advanced chips, such as NVIDIA's. But unlike Biden, Trump has asserted that Washington should extract value from private companies that need its help. The administration has taken stakes in companies with which it has arranged contracts and loans to boost the supply of critical minerals. Secretary of the Interior Doug Bergman told the Journal Friday those stakes will initially be held by a sovereign wealth fund. Trump converted the Intel grant to equity. Despite the dilation to existing shareholders, Intel shares rose. Investors are betting the federal government would steer business to Intel. much as Beijing does for its national champions. Huang's and Sachs' view on NVIDIA's chip sales to China may well have prevailed over opponents on their own merits. Still, the 25% sales share probably helped. The risk, of course, is that Treasury's profits on Intel and sales of chips to China distract from national security. For example, after converting its chips grants to equity, Intel is no longer bound by the conditions that the Biden administration attached to those grants aimed at building certain types of advanced semiconductor capacity in the U.S. At the Council on Foreign Relations this month, Gina Raimondo, who is Biden's Commerce Secretary, oversaw the CHIPS grants, said, "Don't fall into the trap of saying we're going to do this to make money for the government. That's not what this is about. You want to achieve and buy a national security outcome." State capitalism is supposed to benefit the country. Yet there's a great temptation by those in power to equate the state's interests with their own. And the state capitalism starts to look like crony capitalism. Skydance Media, a film studio controlled by David Ellison, agreed last year to merge with Paramount Global. Trump's regulators didn't approve the merger until after Paramount settled a lawsuit brought by Trump against its CBS News division over the editing of an interview with Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris. Paramount, now run by Ellison, is bidding for Warner Brothers Discovery, which has agreed to sell its studios and HBO Max streaming service to Netflix. President Trump has said the ownership of Warner's CNN News channel should change regardless which company buys Warner. Ellison has offered assurance to Trump administration officials that if he bought Warner, he'd make sweeping changes to CNN, a regular target of Trump's ire, the Journal has reported. Trump, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is participating in the bid. Financing is largely coming from Ellison's father, Larry Ellison, controlling shareholder of Oracle and a Trump supporter. In other countries where state capitalism is popular, the outcome is foreordained. In Russia, Hungary, Turkey, and India, critical media have all been bought and muzzled by owners friendly to the ruling party. In the U.S., it remains to be seen whether the market or the state will decide. Write to Greg Ipp at greg.ipp@wsj.com. That's all the time we have today for the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona.